This is a CBC podcast.
Today on The House, is the federal government turning up the temperature only on the richest of the rich?
This impacts a lot more than just wealthy Canadians. Now a cottage could be taxed at a much higher capital gain when they look to sell it.
It's really hard for me to accept this story that there are tons of Canadians, poor unfortunate Canadians, with second homes that they want a tax break on.
I'm Catherine Cullen. This week, who is really getting hit by this federal budget measure? We'll break down the new wealth tax. Also, the Liberals promised the new disability benefit would pull scores of people out of poverty. We'll ask why it's going to fall short. And we'll follow the path of the TMX pipeline expansion and meet people who love it, loathe it, and want to buy it. Plus, worries about sports gambling.
You've got to keep your credibility. All this kind of stuff is building and building and building, and we have a really significant issue with professional sports and gambling, and people have to start waking up to this issue.
An NBA player was just banned for life. What can the government do to fix problems tied to legalizing single-event sport betting? But first, who wins and who loses when the Liberals go after capital gains? The House is now in session. The big political message from this week's budget: the Liberals want to tax the rich.
We're making Canada's tax system more fair by ensuring that the very wealthiest pay their fair share.
They're trying to do that by changing the capital gains tax, but some people are questioning whether some in the middle class might get hit too. Also, will people just move their money to avoid paying? Let's sort it all out. To help us, Allison Christians is the Steichman Chair in Tax Law at McGill University.
So what's a capital gain? Well, let's say you own shares in a Canadian company and you bought some art that has appreciated and you have your principal residence. You bought all those things at a certain price, and if you go sell them at a higher price, the gain is capital gain. The question is whether it's taxable.
Like your home, your primary residence, that profit is not taxable. But profit made on selling other assets, like a cottage or income property, will be taxed. Right now, you pay taxes on 50% of your profit. When the Liberals' new plan kicks into effect in June, any profit in excess of $250,000, well, two-thirds of that money will be subject to tax.
We don't think it's fair that a teacher or electrician pays taxes on 100% of their income, while a multimillionaire pays taxes only on 50% of the passive income they make on capital gains. So we're going to make them pay a little more.
One word, confusion. Another word, disappointment. And probably everybody knew this was coming. We knew at some point in time there would be an increase to the capital gains tax in Canada. This was a little surprising because of how punishing it is to individuals that have owned investment properties or stocks for a long period of time and contributed lots of tax dollars to the Canadian economy, and now they're really feeling punished for all the hard work that they've done.
Barry Schwartz is the Executive Vice President and Chief Investment Officer at Baskin Wealth Management. He manages money for wealthy clients.
You know, I think a lot of people will be looking at changing the way they invest going forward as a result of these new tax rates. So be careful what you wish for, Liberal governments. There could be knock-on effects that you don't realize will happen. For example, those that own businesses may not want to sell those businesses to younger generation as a result of the higher tax rate. Maybe I'll hold on to my business longer. That's not good. That doesn't encourage young people who want to have ownerships and partnerships in businesses, where now the older people who own those investments or shares of businesses may not want to do it. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. People will vote on things that specifically impact their wallets. And this is impactful to a lot of our clients and a lot of, I mean, it's not just Yes, we deal with wealthy Canadians. Yes, I get it. And no one's going to cry for the wealthy that they have to pay more tax. But I think this impacts a lot more than just wealthy Canadians. Many of us may own cottages. We don't see ourselves as wealthy, but well, now a cottage could be taxed at a much higher capital gain when they look to sell it.
If somebody's sitting on property worth millions and they don't need the money in their lifetime, and you're worried about what's going to happen when they try to pass that on to the next generation, that to me is not middle class.
So while the Liberals keep saying this is about a tiny fraction of Canadians, the ultra wealthy.
Again, as you heard the Prime Minister said earlier, it's really the ultra wealthy that will be paying additional taxes.
There's a lot of public debate right now about whether some other people who are not multimillionaires could still get caught up in the tax the rich net. Sahir Khan is Executive Vice President at the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy at the University of Ottawa.
This is not going to affect a lot of people, probably a little more than kind of got played out on budget day. It's not just the rich. There are people that have second homes, investment properties, cottages, and there'll be some impact. Not nearly as dire, I think, as some people are screaming about. I think there, you know, lots of people will plan their way around this problem, and it's going to probably impact a few people that are kind of unintended casualties of this. And for them, yeah, there's going to be a bit of a bite.
To be honest, from a lot of our clients, hoping that there'll be a new regime change sooner rather than later, and smarter minds will figure out that raising taxes like this doesn't lead to the result they want.
But will some people just move their money, meaning the Liberals won't be able to raise the kinds of revenue they hoped? Alison Christians again.
It's hard for me to understand, you know, this worry that, like, capital is going to run for the hills, the sky is falling. It's a modest base increase. For most people, this is not going to affect their investment. But as we say, we don't know what people will do to avoid even one more dollar of tax, even though they live in a society that is funded by tax revenues and makes them rich. So I don't know how to answer that question. Like, are they going to run for the hills? Are they going to run for their accountants? Yes, they're going to run for their accountants. And are they going to ask those accountants to figure out a way to help them save a dollar in tax and not contribute to the Canadian economy if they possibly can? Yes, they're going to do that. Taxpayers are always going to do that. You can count on them to do that.
With the Canada Disability Benefit, we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to lift hundreds of thousands of people out of poverty. We have an opportunity of a lifetime to send a message to our citizens with disabilities that they matter, that we will no longer sit by and let them struggle. And I hope everyone...
That was the pitch from then-Minister for Disability Inclusion when the government was working on the Canada Disability Benefit. Carla Quattro said those words more than a year and a half ago. But the critics say now the final numbers don't live up to that goal. The federal budget revealed those eligible for the benefit will get $200 a month. Even the parliamentary budget officer last fall suggested the benefit would need as much as $14,000 a year to bring someone up to the poverty line. Edward Ferzel was closely watching the details coming out of the budget. He's the executive director of KW Accessibility in the Kitchener-Waterloo region of southwestern Ontario. Edward, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me today.
What was your reaction when you saw what the disability benefit was actually going to look like in the budget?
Well, it was mixed. At first, I was very happy to hear that something was going to be done, but that quickly turned to disappointment when we took a look at the numbers. $200 a month really does very little to help people living below the poverty line. Today, most provinces, the disability allowance is only about $1,200 a month. So an extra $200 a month would bring it to $1,400, maybe $1,500 a month.
What are people saying to you this week as they've heard the news about this benefit?
They're confused. They're disheartened, greatly disheartened. You know, a lot of people are having issues with just the basic necessities, food, housing, rents are going up all over the place. You know, the price of food has skyrocketed. So people are coming to me saying, how is this $200 going to help?
Can you think of a particular story you've heard, a specific story that someone's told you that you could share with us?
Well, our agency runs various programs for people with disabilities. We keep the cost at a bare minimum to ensure that money is not an issue for them or a barrier. But I'm hearing people can't attend our free programs because they don't even have enough money for bus fare to attend. So, you know, people are being trapped in their homes more and more. So they're very, very disillusioned. And we're seeing a lot more social isolation and depression setting in with people with disabilities.
When we talked to Minister Carla Quattro on this program about the disability benefit, she talked a lot about equality, about the idea that this was really something that was going to even out the scales because so many Canadians living with disabilities live below the poverty line. And yet, it sounds like the government hasn't quite met this moment for a lot of the people who have been waiting on this benefit. What kind of message do you think that sends?
It makes me wonder who she thinks people will be equal to. At that level of income, there's nobody that's living a decent life with an extra $200. Is really just a drop in the bucket.
What would you say to a minister or the prime minister about the decision that they made?
I would ask them how they would like to survive on $1,500 a month and have them explain to us how they can pay for rent, pay for food, and go to any type of social activity, let alone a concert or just visiting friends, just the transportation to go back and forth to a friend's house, let alone a restaurant. How can they give us a budget for someone to be able to do that?
Edward, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Edward Feruzel is the executive director of KW Accessibility. We did ask to speak to Kamal Khera, the federal minister of diversity, inclusion, and persons with disabilities. She was not available. Instead, I spoke with the parliamentary secretary to the minister, Samir Zubiri. Here's some of our conversation. The minister's predecessor, Carla Qualtro, said on this program of the disability benefit, "I've been very clear we are going to lift people out of poverty." Your own party platform said that this benefit would reduce poverty the way the Guaranteed Income Supplement and the Canada Child Benefit did. Would you say that $200 a month does that?
This is a really historic benefit, what's happened right now in this budget. And this represents decades of advocacy from the disability community. And for the first time, there is a concrete benefit that is in the budget that has received the single largest funding within the budget, the single largest item that is funded in this budget, to the tune of $6.1 billion over 5 years. We have worked with the disability community. This is a first step. It's something concrete that we can build upon, and it does represent something I would say significant, which is up to $2,400 per year for an eligible person.
And yet the pledge was we are going to lift people, thousands of people out of poverty. The March of Dimes says the funding envelope won't raise the income of any person receiving disability income support in any jurisdiction to or above the poverty line. Do you acknowledge that this does not do what you told Canadians it would?
I think that this is something that is a first step. And it's not the last say in this advocacy, in this struggle to have dignity and respect for persons with disability. This is a critical first step, and it is something historic, something that has been decades in the making, and it's something that we can concretely build upon.
You say a first step. Your colleagues keep saying that. The Liberals first pledged this in the throne speech in 2020. It won't be in people's bank accounts until 2025. What message does it send when it takes 5 years to get to the first step?
as somebody who's advocated on several different causes, I know that it's not something that is easy to see and to have that type of delay.
It's a disappointment.
It is something that is like quite challenging. At the same time, this is a win. This is a win for the community and for all Canadians, Canadian society, a win for promoting basic fairness.
So you would tell Edward Ferruzzle, who we just heard from, that he should feel that this is a win?
I think we need to recognize the historic moment and that this isn't the last word in the chapter. But I do think we need to recognize that this is a historic moment and that also we need to note that this is the single largest a line item that's funded in the budget. Of all the other things, of all the other hundreds of items that we have spoken about in the budget, this is the single most funded item. Not to take away from the fact that this is a first step, an important one, but to note at the same time, it is the single largest funded item.
And yet it does not meet the level that the government set forth. Minister Qualtro said this was a question of equality, bringing people up above the poverty line. Was the decision made that equality was too expensive?
This budget is about basic fairness. One key aspect is the disability benefit. Another global aspect of the budget is generational fairness. And
is it fair to promise to take people out of poverty and then not do it, Samir Zabiri?
We need to continue advocating and pushing. And I am committed to that. And I ask advocates, let's work, continue to work to do that. And I think that, you know, this is, as I say, and as we say as a government, this is a first step. This isn't the last word in this saga. And I'm committed to working hand in hand, and our government is committed to working hand in hand with the community so that we can bring this to the next level into the future. But this moment is also historic, and I think we need to recognize that as we talk about this. The fact that it has very significant funding, it is permanent into the future, the $6.1 billion over 5 years, and then it doesn't stop there. It continues for $1.4 billion thereafter. We are the government that has brought this in. No other government has done so in the past at all. And I would say that we are the only government that will continue to push and to enhance these benefits that relate to basic fairness.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Catherine.
Samir Zabiri is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Diversity, Inclusion, and Persons with Disabilities. Still to come on the House podcast, single-event sports betting was legalized under the Liberals, but does it need to be reined in? That's in about 15 minutes. I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to the show that helps you make sense of the political decisions that affect your life. A new episode of The House drops every Saturday. Let us know what you think about what you hear. Send us an email, thehouse@cbc.ca. It almost sounds like a celebration. The federal government is pointing to revenues expected from the soon-to-be-opened Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion.
And last week, the Bank of Canada estimated that this project alone will add 0.25 percentage point to Canada's GDP.
The expansion is expected to start shipping oil from Alberta to BC's Lower Mainland in just a few weeks. It's been a long time coming, 12 years of protests, court challenges, and regulatory hurdles. The CBC's Alison Dempster went to meet people who worked on the pipeline, those who hope to one day own it, and those who mourn the fact it's been built.
So it's over in this corner here.
So and it went from one end of our community right to the other.
In Edson, Alberta, Mayor Kevin Zahara shows me where one of the most contentious mega projects in recent Canadian history runs through his town. Edson sits along the first leg of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which cuts through a beloved ballpark.
So this is a wonderful place in the summertime. It is bustling with activity.
But the pipeline project meant a timeout for a section of the ballpark. Trans Mountain is kicking in $300,000 for a revamp. There will be 16 ball diamonds when it's finished.
There has been a lot of disappointment as the construction has taken longer than expected, but we are now seeing this facility being upgraded, which is really important.
I'm trying to resist the obvious Field of Dreams reference here, unsuccessfully. But I guess if you build it, they will come, is the idea.
Well, if you build it, it will be utilized, especially out here.
Zahara is confident that's true of new baseball diamonds and the pipeline expansion, even though it's involved extra innings and no shortage of curveballs. For Edson, the project meant jobs, along with plenty of hotel and restaurant business during construction.
There was a ripple effect throughout the community, and it was very positive.
Soon, the newly twinned pipeline will nearly triple the flow of crude from Alberta to the West Coast to 890,000 barrels a day.
This has been, you know, talked about for many, many years. So seeing that oil flowing is going to be vitally important, and very excited to see that happen.
A lack of pipelines has been a thorn in the side of Alberta oil producers for years. It's a large part of the reason they take a price discount on their product compared to U.S. competitors. TMX, Canada's only pipeline to the West Coast, will help companies reach new markets in Asia and California. That means a more competitive price for Alberta oil.
If we can get our resources to other markets, that's just wonderfully positive for us. I can't wait for that day to happen.
At a coffee shop in Edson, there's a sense of relief now that the project is nearing the finish line. But some people in the community are frustrated with the cost.
I've seen so many pipelines go in the ground 3 to 4 times as fast. They seem to use every excuse as they can to put a hold on things because of environmental and, you know, issues going on. And these delays just cause taxpayers and everybody, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars. If the government wasn't involved and you had normal pipeline companies going and doing it, I mean, it would be done probably a third of the time. Because, you know, we're in the oil patch. We get things done.
The original Trans Mountain Pipeline was built in the early 1950s.
It was logical that a pipeline be run to the great seaport city of Vancouver from the newly developed oil fields of Alberta.
It took 2.5 years to build.
And through it, of course, the wonderful fluid that would turn the wheels of commerce and industry.
6 decades later...
Shame on you! Shame on you!
Things had changed.
What are you going to tell your grandkids?
Kinder Morgan's plans to twin the line were greeted with fierce opposition from activists concerned about environmental impacts, climate change, and Indigenous rights.
No, Kinder Morgan!
No, Kinder Morgan!
The BC government attempted to block the project through the courts.
Kinder Morgan is hitting pause on the expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline in British Columbia. It comes after weeks of protests.
In 2018, Kinder Morgan threw in the towel. The federal government decided to step in and bought the pipeline for $4.5 billion. After another court challenge, more Indigenous consultation, and further environmental review, the project got a green light in 2019.
Today, I am announcing that our government has newly approved the Trans Mountain Expansion Project going forward.
Where some saw national interest, others saw opportunity for jobs in Indigenous communities.
My name is Paul Donald. I'm the CEO at Simp Resources Group.
Donald runs the economic development arm of the Simp First Nation in BC's southern interior.
Roughly a third of that pipeline goes through our traditional territory. So without our participation, without our stamp of approval, it would not have gone ahead.
Simp Resources grew from roughly 40 employees to 200 at the peak of pipeline construction.
It's given us the ability to show what we can do as a company.
Donald's crew was contracted by Trans Mountain to help test and repair a 150-kilometer stretch of the pipeline that runs through Jasper National Park and Mount Robson Provincial Park. That meant navigating strict environmental standards.
Under that bridge.
Yeah. Some species are more hardy than others in what their tolerance levels to disturbance and noises are.
At the Simp Resources office, employees swap stories about the wildlife they tried to protect during the project. Engineer Chris Sabula says crews made sure not to disturb nesting birds. They temporarily relocated fish and rare plants.
We had a team of people trapping the toads, and then once we got those toads, we relocated them to an area and fenced around the location so they can't get back in before we started working.
How do you feel about the lengths you went to and the time it took?
It was a contentious issue at the First Nation level within the community. You know, it certainly wasn't, you know, everyone raised their hands and said, yeah, let's do this. Everyone raised their hands and said, okay, I have some concerns. So Trans Mountain had to make those commitments, otherwise it wouldn't have gone through.
Over the course of the project, contractors also dealt with numerous setbacks, wildfires, devastating flooding, and a pandemic. all adding to the price tag of $34 billion, almost five times the original estimate. A troubling number, especially for those who didn't want the pipeline in the first place.
I feel defeated. We're at the end of that pipeline, and we're going to suffer.
Ray Harris is an elder and commercial fisherman.
My traditional name is Shalquilam. I'm from the Chiminas tribe on the east side of Vancouver Island here.
Harris pushed against the Trans Mountain Project in regulatory hearings, sharing traditional stories about the sea life his community relies on and concerns about already stressed fish populations. The pipeline expansion means the number of oil tankers traveling through coastal waters will soon increase from about one per week to one a day.
I just think that we were used to say, well, we heard from you and we're still going to do it. Sometimes we're just dismissed. We're dismissed by industry, and industry has a great influence on our governments.
Harris is not alone with his concerns. For other coastal First Nations, TMX brings too many risks.
My name is Reuben George of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation and manager of Sacred Trust, which is the initiative to stop the TMX pipeline. Right now, we're standing at the shores of Cates Park, Wayewachin. Just looking right across from us is the TMX port. Wayewachin means facing the water, but this also was an old ancient site of my people. You know, when us, we would say,
as George explains his ancestral connection to the waters of the Burrard Inlet, he's interrupted.
It's going to, right there. I think there's two.
By a welcome sight.
Sorry. You never ever see sea lions up here. Wow, never see sea lions up here. It's beautiful.
Protecting marine life is one of George's big concerns with TMX. Canada's energy regulator has said the project would cause significant adverse environmental effects on the southern resident killer whale population.
We take all the risk with minimum benefits. And I think the more Canadians learn about the disastrous costs of this, and not if, but when a spill will happen, that's the legacy that I think the Liberals will have.
George is also leery about the federal government's plans to sell the pipeline after it's complete. Potential buyers include a number of Indigenous coalitions.
What it still comes out to is economic smallpox for the First Nations. It's a stranded asset.
Michael Labordet sees it differently.
You drove over it, so when you turned in off west.
The pipeline runs through his small ranch on the Whispering Pines Reserve north of Kamloops.
I have 5 head of horses. That's why I wear a cowboy hat, and that's why I
Labordet is also the executive vice president of the Western Indigenous Pipeline Group. Its goal, a 51% stake in the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
This is our chance to have a substantial piece of the pipeline where our influence cannot be denied. You know, everybody talks, well, how are we going to do reconciliation? And they ask this question over and over. Well, include us.
Labordet says almost 40 First Nations in BC and Alberta have signed on to own a piece of the pipeline.
The revenue from the pipeline would help a great deal, a great deal. And that's what they're looking for. They want that autonomy. Then you can address the housing shortages on your reserves. You can address the elders' needs on your reserves. You can address the school needs on your reserves. It would be a game changer here.
But the pipeline project is so over budget, industry analysts say taxpayers should brace for some upfront losses as Ottawa looks to sell it.
There's probably $15+ billion that are going to be written off from this experience.
Richard Masson is an executive fellow with the University of Calgary's School of Public Policy. He says the cost overruns also mean oil companies will pay higher tolls to move their product.
Some of those costs get passed through to the shippers, and it does mean that there's less profitability for them, and less profitability means less royalties and less taxes for Canada. And so, yeah, it makes sense probably to go do a look back on what can we learn from this, and how do we ensure that it doesn't happen again? Because my view is we wouldn't have built it if we knew it was going to cost $34 billion. It's done. There's benefits that are going to come from it, but I can't see it allowing for anybody to go to their board of directors and say, now I want to build another one of these. Or based on this experience, I want to try and revive Keystone XL, right? These are the things that really scare investors away.
Come May 1st, Trans Mountain says the pipeline will be ready to deliver bigger shipments of Alberta oil and a complicated legacy. For The House, I'm Alison Dempster in Calgary.
So, will the Liberals reap a political dividend for buying and building a pipeline? Joining me now is the Globe and Mail's Kelly Kreiderman in Calgary. Welcome back to The House.
Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Glad to talk to you. Now, Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland this week cited the Trans Mountain Pipeline in her budget speech, saying it means growth for the economy. We know, though, that actually building the pipeline also went dramatically over budget. Can the Liberals call this a win?
That's a really good question. And I'm really interested when, you know, the pipeline is actually operating, when supposedly I think there'll be some kind of ribbon cutting, whether there are any federal politicians who show up for that and whether they feel, you know, a sense of national pride in this project. It was interesting, Minister Freeland's comments talking about the golden weld, the final weld for the project, and the 0.25 percentage point to our GDP will add to the second quarter. It was interesting to hear her talking in positive tones about the project because generally, you don't hear federal Liberal cabinet ministers talking in positive tones about the project, and that's because they know there is a political liability in talking a lot about how they have bought and still own the Trans Mountain Pipeline and the expansion project. As much as you can talk about it in economic terms, for a long time in the 9 years that they've been in office, this has been a liability rather than something they would want to brag about.
What about in Alberta? Do they get any credit there for buying the pipeline?
They do and they don't. You know, there's a sense in Alberta that projects like this would go ahead if the federal Liberals didn't have the environmental rules and regulations and reach into the energy file that they did. And that buying the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion years ago was the last resort to get this project built. So there's certainly that feeling. There also was years ago skepticism whether this project would ever be built. And, you know, I have to say it's night and day the difference between now and 3-4 years ago. Of course, when oil prices were much lower, when the economy here was much weaker, and when there was great skepticism that this project would actually ever be completed. So I think, you know, there is recognition that this project would not have been built without the federal government buying it and completing it. And there will be recognition of that. I think it's baked in already to the like or dislike of the federal Liberals in the province already, frankly.
Obviously, this gravely disappointed environmentalists who support the Liberals or even those who don't. Can we say politically whether this was worth it for the Liberals?
No, I think it's almost a wash for them in many ways. I think, you know, when environmentalists look at the lay of the land, I understand why there is disappointment in many federal Liberal climate policies and the purchase of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. But I also think that the federal Liberals have risked a lot of political capital on their climate policies, especially when you look at the options. If you're a voter where the environment or climate is your number one issue, I think looking at the options and looking at the polling numbers for the Conservatives, you would have to say that, you know, the federal Liberals risked a lot of political capital in bringing in carbon pricing and bringing in a number of net zero policies that have an effect on the economy and have created a lot of controversy. It's all relative on who you're comparing to.
How difficult is it going to be for the government to sell this pipeline?
So we don't have any clarity that there is a really serious buyer at this point. And I think that we might be waiting a while and the federal government might be holding onto this pipeline and having ownership of the pipeline longer than they think. I think they need to not only sell the pipeline, they need to sell it in a way that represents what they wanted to do with buying this pipeline. And I think Indigenous ownership has to be a part of the eventual ownership structure, and figuring out how significant that ownership size is. There is no clear buyer. There's going to be a lot of discussion about indigenous groups, about pension funds, about other pipeline companies and who operates it and the structure of the eventual ownership. But I think having gone so over budget, we're talking about $34 billion and counting for this project. The federal government is unlikely to recoup all that money in a sale, and especially in a sale that happens quickly or where they're seen as being desperate to sell in any way. It might be a longer process than certainly anybody in the federal Liberal Party had hoped for.
Okay. The Globe and Mail's Kelly Kreiderman, thank you so much for this.
Thanks so much.
In the almost 3 years since single-event sports betting was made legal in Canada, it has become very big business. But there are challenges, too. This week, Toronto Raptors player Jonte Porter was banned for life from the NBA. The league says he violated its rules by betting on games and sharing inside information with other bettors. League Commissioner Adam Silver calls it the cardinal sin of professional sports. Porter's case has raised concerns that betting is compromising the integrity of professional sports and that it may only get worse without government intervention. To learn more, I headed up to Parliament Hill to speak to the man whose private member's bill, C-218, kicked off the expansion of legal betting in Canada. Conservative MP Kevin Waugh. In light of what we saw this week with Jonte Porter, are you concerned that there aren't enough guardrails in the gambling system to protect people from manipulation by the players themselves?
Yeah, it was a hot topic when we went through the single event sports betting. I've been expecting this to come. I thought they've done a very good job on Jonte Porter of the Toronto Raptors, and I'll tell you why. I'm not in favor of proposition bets, and this was one of them. It was a parlay, and he was involved in one of them. And, you know, the $80,000 that was bet, legally, I'll say, would have turned into over $1 million. But that didn't happen. I'm especially pleased with the gaming sites that flagged it right away. And I got to give the Toronto Raptors a lot of credit. They suspended Porter right away. And then at the end of the season, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, made the statement of suspension for life. So I think we've got a lot of checkpoints here. This will not be the first time this has happened. But I do think it does send a signal to athletes and to those of, let's say, shady circumstances that want to fix sports, it does send a signal that people are watching on this.
When I hear you say, well, we knew something like this was going to happen, it probably won't be the last time, I wonder, some people may ask themselves, well, maybe you shouldn't have done this in the first place.
Oh, no. I think it needed to be done, and I'll tell you why, Catherine. You know, Ontario, I saw the numbers today, what they are betting, and those are billions of dollars. Those are monies that we would never have got without my bill, C-218, single event sports betting. They were going offshore. In fact, a lot of it is still going offshore, to be honest with you. But at least we're trying to control the gambler here in Canada because when you bet in Canada, they have what you bet. They know if you've bet too much. They have a database now that we can follow in this country. So it's something that we'll have to regulate more. I think it is a flag for every organization, for every league, professional league. I will say this. I give the NCAA a lot of credit. They stopped the proposition bets right away when these stories started, and that's good at the amateur level.
What about the way it has changed, not just the culture of sports, but we're drenched in gambling ads now, Kevin Waugh. What do you say to people who say, I don't like this, it's probably encouraging more people to gamble?
Well, there's no question that the ads are on every TV station, every 30 seconds. We're coming up to the National Hockey League playoffs in this country, and I think you're going to see more and more ads, unfortunately, in the first round of the playoffs. We expected that. Should there be changes in the advertising? Well, that's up to the CRTC. I know the Senate has a bill going that, you know, maybe we can restrict some of the ads, the times that they are coming, you know, and maybe that's something we all need to look at. The provinces have the say in this, And let me say this in Saskatchewan. We did it right. We only have one provider, PlayNow.com. It is run by SIGA, the Gaming Institute in Saskatchewan. So really, legally, we only have one product in Saskatchewan, where Ontario is the wild, wild west. And I'm going to criticize the Ontario Lottery Corporation. They've opened it right up. There's over 45 legal betting sites, and it's ridiculous. There's too much competition in Ontario, and I see in Saskatchewan, we only have one. It's way too many companies involved in Ontario.
So you're pushing for more sort of a tightening of the rules on the provincial level. But let me ask you, on the federal level, should it be explicitly illegal to match fix or change behavior to win bets?
Well, we're looking at it on the Canadian Ethics and Sport on the situation of Mr. Porter. They came out right away. Yeah, that's something that I think the ethics in this country will have to look at. This, as I said, is the first real incident that has taken place with a Canadian team. There could be more coming down. I suspect as we go on the betting side, there could be more, unfortunately.
Do you have any regrets about legalizing?
No, none whatsoever. It's added to the game. I think the NHL had their best attendance this year. You know, there's the dark side of it. I understand that. I hear from a lot of people, A, they don't like the ads. B, there is addictions to it. You know, when I stood up and talked about 218 during the year and a half, I wanted provinces, yeah, you're taking the money in now because the jurisdiction is yours. But I also put a threat to the provinces. I want to see some money to addictions. And I think each province and territory that is involved in gaming should release those numbers, how much money you're putting into addictions, because it is an area of concern.
Conservative MP Kevin Waugh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One group that's hoping to avoid more instances like Jaunte Porter's is the Canadian Centre for Ethics in Sport. They oversee issues including fair play and anti-doping in this country. And just this week, they put out a draft policy to prevent match fixing. Jeremy Luke is president and CEO of the Canadian Centre for Ethics in Sport. Welcome to the House.
Thank you very much for having me.
What is it about legalizing single game sports betting that is leading to the kinds of cases like Jaunte Porter's that we're seeing?
Well, I think what it is it's really the proliferation of sport gambling in Canada that has resulted from that legalization, where we're seeing massive amounts of advertising associated with our professional sport leagues and other sport leagues, and the ability to wager on not just the outcome of competitions, but on every single part of competitions, whether it's a free throw in basketball or it's a serve in tennis, that has really driven up the risk of potential manipulation around these competitions when it comes to betting.
We just heard from Conservative MP Kevin Waugh, who says, okay, in this case, Jaunte Porter, the gaming sites flagged it, the leagues responded, the biggest transaction, the one that would have had the $1 million payout, was flagged and stopped. The system is working in this case. How do you respond?
I think there is some positive aspects to this particular situation, where it is positive that through the legalization of single event sport betting and the ability to regulate it, that we're able to ensure policies are in place and that these things can be flagged and that they can be dealt with. So I think that's really positive. I think what's missing, though, is a really comprehensive approach that would apply across all of our sports, not just professional sports, that makes sure that Canadian sports athletes, our national level athletes, our Olympic level athletes are all protected through policies and education. And that's the part I think that's missing. And that's the part that we've really been working hard to try and bring forward as an organization.
Okay. Here on the House, obviously, we're focused on the political part of the story. So you have, as you said, you put out this draft policy. You're looking at things that leagues can do, measures that they should be engaging in. What is the single most important thing politicians could do to help clean up this situation?
There's two things that I would suggest politicians can do. The first is the ratification of the Council of Europe's Convention on the Prevention of Competition Manipulation, which sounds fancy. Essentially what it is it's a treaty that the Council of Europe developed. It's now been signed on to by over 30 different countries, and it requires governments who ratify it to put in place a framework, including laws, to ensure that sport is protected from the risks of competition manipulation. So it includes how do you ensure that regulators and betting operators from province to province are able to cooperate with one another? How do we ensure law enforcement can deal with this issue? Because often it's not just one individual involved in these cases. It can be organized crime, given the volume of money that's bet on sport.
So let me ask you on that one. Have you gotten any indication from the federal government that they're, well, I was going to say willing to play ball there. I apologize for the inadvertent pun, but that they're ready to engage.
No, not yet. So it was an observation that was identified when Bill C-218, which was the bill that removed mm-hmm. the prohibition in the criminal code around single sport betting. It was identified as an observation by the Senate, indicating that this is something that we should be looking into as a country, but we have not moved in that direction.
Okay. And what about the second thing on your list?
The second point that we have been advocating for is making sure that we have a comprehensive policy that would apply across all of our federally funded sport organizations that deals with this issue. So it would identify what you can and can't do. Can I bet on my own sport? Can I not bet on sports? How would it work? And that's the approach that we've taken in Canada when it comes to anti-doping. We have one policy across all our federally funded sports, and the government mandates that federally funded sport organizations adopt that policy and they implement it.
Kevin Waugh told us there are too many betting sites in some provinces, that more regulation is needed specifically on cases of particular provinces. You talked about Ontario. There's too much going on. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think the argument is a strong one. I think we were very quick to legalize single event sport betting a couple of years ago through Bill C-218. But what I would suggest hasn't followed is a thorough analysis of the implications of that, the steps that we need to take to mitigate harm to athletes and others. I mean, my understanding for the rationale for bringing forward legalized single event sport betting was that it was happening anyway. It's happening in the black market and the gray market. It's unregulated. It's unsafe. It's essentially a harm reduction strategy to legalize sport wagering. But what comes with that then is the need for the government to have some sort of task force or some sort of commission to really look at what are the harms that are flowing from legalized single event sport betting, competition manipulation being one, but there are others. And how do we really mitigate against those harms so that we don't find ourselves a couple of years down the road where inadvertently we're causing significant harm both to our sports system and to our athletes?
Quickly, do you think it would also be beneficial to have more severe consequences for people who are caught, particularly athletes who are caught with this kind of match fixing, like criminal consequences?
I think it's really important that there are clear criminal laws that deal with competition manipulation. What we've learned from other countries and through the Council of Europe's convention is that often this isn't one individual that is doing something around manipulating parts of a competition. Given the volume of money that's wagered on sport, and as an example, one CFL game can generate close to $6 million of sport betting through legal channels. When there's such a significant amount of money that can be wagered on sport, it can then involve organized crime, money laundering, other really significant legal issues. And having the ability for law enforcement to engage in this space is particularly important when it comes to those types of issues. So I'd say that we need laws to deal with this, but more so around people who are involved in this through organized crime than particularly for one individual.
I've heard it argued that for stories like Jontay Porter's, it could be the death of sports leagues because fans are going to start questioning what they're seeing. How serious do you think the risk to professional sport is in all of this?
Well, I think that there's a risk to professional sport. I think there's a risk to all sport. And I've suggested in the past that this is a risk that is at the same level as doping in sport. And because of how easily manipulation can occur in sports and the volume of betting that's happening on sport, that if we turn a blind eye or we are complacent and assume this is an isolated incident, it's not that big a deal, that we could be facing really significant scandals around the integrity of sport and particularly around the safety of those people who participate in sport. And in Canada, I mean, we invest in sport because it's a tremendous public asset. It creates character and builds character in our youth, and it brings tremendous amounts of joy to our society. And you'd hate to see for all of that to be lost because of legalized single event sport betting.
Okay. A lot to consider there. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jeremy Luke is the head of the Canadian Center for Ethics in Sport. Okay, that is it for us this week. Our crew on the house is Kristen Everson, Emma Godmere, Christian Poslang, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. Thanks also this week to Miguel Plant. I'm Catherine Cullen. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.